clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the recording library of West Texas 24-hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Because our regularly scheduled program was not available at broadcast time, we bring you the following special presentation.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, up plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, with Western Short Stories. Today we're going to be reading a selection from Zane Grey. Zane Grey was one of the premier and most prolific writers of Western novels and short stories. I've selected a passage from his novel Call of the Canyon to read today. In addition to being a best-selling book, Call of the Canyon was also made into a successful silent film in 1923. It has always appealed to me because it is so evocative of the grandeur of Arizona's open spaces. Let's introduce the story. Glenn Kilbourne returns, gassed and shell-shocked from World War I, a broken man both physically and emotionally. His determination to return home to his fiancée, New York socialite Carly Birch, gave him strength during the darker times of the war. Yet upon his return, he finds that the country he fought for does little for its returning soldiers, and the New York society life he lived before the war no longer appeals to him. So Glenn sets out for the West. He needs time to heal. He journeys to Oak Creek, Arizona, where he almost dies from the physical and mental after effects of the global conflict. But slowly he begins to recover. For 4 years, Glenn stays isolated. Although he writes to Carly, she begins to suspect that she is losing him. So she heads west to fetch him back, where she discovers the magic and beauty of the Arizona landscape. We join the story midway through Chapter 1, as she is embarking on her railroad journey west. Carly Birch possessed in full degree the prevailing modern craze for speed. She loved a motor car ride at 60 miles an hour along a smooth, straight road, or better, on the level seashore of Ormond, where on moonlit nights the white blanched sand seemed to flash toward her. Therefore, quite to her taste, was the 20th Century Limited, which was hurtling her on the way to Chicago. The unceasingly smooth and even rush of the train satisfied something in her. An old lady sitting in an adjoining seat with a companion amused Carly by the remark, "I wish we didn't go so fast. People nowadays haven't time to draw a comfortable breath. Suppose we should run off the track." Carly had no fear of express trains or motor cars or transatlantic liners. In fact, she prided herself in not being afraid of anything. But she wondered if this was not the false courage of association with a crowd. Before this enterprise at hand, she could not remember anything she had undertaken alone. Her thrills seemed to be in abeyance to the end of her journey. That night, her sleep was permeated with the steady, low whirring of the wheels. Once, roused by a jerk, she lay awake in the darkness, while the thought came to her that she and all her fellow passengers were really at the mercy of the engineer. Who was he, and did he stand on his throttle keen and vigilant, thinking of the lives entrusted to him? Such thoughts vaguely annoyed Carly, and she dismissed them. A long half-day wait in Chicago was a tedious preliminary to the second part of her journey, but at last she found herself aboard the California Limited and went to bed with a relief quite strange to her. The glare of the sun under the curtain awakened her. Propped up on her pillows, she looked out at apparently endless green fields or pastures, dotted now and then with little farmhouses and tree-skirted villages. This country, she thought, must be the prairie land she remembered lay west of the Mississippi. Later, in the dining car, the steward smilingly answered her question. "This is Kansas, and those green fields out there are the wheat that feeds the nation." Carly was not impressed. The color of the short wheat appeared soft and rich, and the boundless fields stretched away monotonously. She had not known there was so much flat land in the world, and she imagined it might be a fine country for automobile roads. When she got back to her seat, she drew the blinds down and read her magazines. Then, tiring of that, she went back to the observation car. Carly was accustomed to attracting attention and did not resent it, unless she was annoyed. The train evidently had a full complement of passengers who, as far as Carly could see, were people not of her station in life. The glare from the many windows and the rather crass interest of several men drove her back to her own section. There she discovered that someone had drawn up her window shades. Carly promptly pulled them down and settled herself comfortably. Then she heard a woman speak, not particularly low. "I thought people traveled west to see the country." And a man replied rather dryly, "Well, not always." His companion went on, "If that girl was mine, I'd let down her skirt." The man laughed and replied, "Martha, you're sure behind the times. Look at the pictures in these magazines." Such remarks amused Carly, and later she took advantage of an opportunity to notice her neighbors. They appeared a rather quaint old couple, reminding her of the natives of country towns in the Adirondacks. She was not amused, however, when another of her woman neighbors, speaking low, referred to her as a lunger. Carly appreciated the fact that she was pale, but she assured herself that there ended any possible resemblance she might have to a consumptive. And she was somewhat pleased to hear this woman's male companion forcibly voice her own convictions. In fact, he was nothing if not admiring. Kansas was interminably long to Carly, and she went to sleep before riding out of it. Next morning, she found herself looking out at the rough gray and black land of New Mexico. She searched the horizon for mountains, but there did not appear to be any. She received a vague, slow dawning impression that was hard to define. She did not like the country, though that was not the impression which eluded her. Bare gray flats, low, scrub-fringed hills, bleak cliffs, jumble after jumble of rocks, and occasionally a long vista down a valley. Somehow compelling, these passed before her gaze until she tired of them. Where was the West Glenn had written about? One thing seemed sure, and it was that every mile of this crude country brought her nearer to him. This recurring thought gave Carly all the pleasure she had felt so far in this endless ride. It struck her that England or France could be dropped down into New Mexico and scarcely noticed. By and by the sun grew hot and the train wound slowly and creakingly upgrade. The car became full of dust, all of which was disagreeable to Carly. She dozed on her pillow for hours until she was stirred by a passenger crying out delightedly, "Look, Indians!" Carly looked, not without interest. As a child, she had read about Indians, and memory returned images both colorful and romantic. From the car window, she espied dusty flat barrens, low squat mud houses, and queer-looking little people. Children naked or extremely ragged and dirty, women in loose garments with flares of red, and men in white man's garb, slovenly and motley. All these strange individuals stared apathetically as the train slowly passed. "Indians," muttered Carly incredulously. "Well, if they are the noble red people, my illusions are dispelled." She did not look out of the window again, not even when the brakeman called out the remarkable name of Albuquerque. Next day, Carly's languid attention quickened to the name of Arizona, and to the frowning red walls of rock, and to the vast rolling stretches of cedar-dotted land. Nevertheless, it affronted her. This was no country for people to live in, and so far as she could see, it was indeed uninhabited. Her sensations were not, however, limited to sight. She became aware of unfamiliar, disturbing little shocks or vibrations in her eardrums, and after that a disagreeable bleeding of the nose. The porter told her this was owing to the altitude. Thus, one thing and another kept Carly most of the time away from the window, so that she really saw very little of the country. From what she had seen, she drew the conviction that she had not missed much. At sunset, she deliberately gazed out to discover what an Arizona sunset was like. Just a pale yellow flare. She had seen better than that above the Palisades. Not until reaching Winslow did she realize how near she was to her journey's end, and that she would arrive at Flagstaff after dark. She grew conscious of nervousness. Suppose Flagstaff were like these other queer little towns? Not only once, but several times before the train slowed down for her destination, did Carly wish she had sent Glenn word to meet her. And when, presently, she found herself standing out in the dark, cold, windy night before a dim-lit railroad station, she more than regretted her decision to surprise Glenn. But that was too late, and she must make the best of her poor judgment. Men were passing to and fro on the platform, some of whom appeared to be very dark of skin and eye, and were probably Mexicans. At length, an expressman approached Carly, soliciting patronage. He took her bags, and, depositing them in a wagon, he pointed up the wide street. "One block up and turn, Hotel Weatherford." Then he drove off. Carly followed, carrying her small satchel. A cold wind, driving the dust, stung her face as she crossed the street to a high sidewalk that extended along the block. There were lights in the stores and on the corners, yet she seemed impressed by a dark, cold, windy bigness. Many people, mostly men, were passing up and down, and there were motor cars everywhere. No one paid any attention to her. Gaining the corner of the block, she turned and was relieved to see the hotel sign. As she entered the lobby, a clicking of pool balls and the discordant rasp of a phonograph assailed her ears. The expressman set down her bags and left Carly standing there. The clerk or proprietor was talking from behind his desk to several men, and there were loungers in the lobby. The air was thick with tobacco smoke. No one paid any attention to Carly. At length, she stepped up to the desk and interrupted the conversation there. "Is this a hotel?" she queried brusquely. The shirt-sleeved individual leisurely turned and replied, "Yes, ma'am." And Carly said, "No one would recognize it by the courtesy shown. I've been standing here waiting to register." With the same leisurely case and a cool, laconic stare, the clerk turned the look toward her. "Reckon people round here ask for what they want." Carly made no further comment. She assuredly recognized that what she had been accustomed to could not be expected out here. What she most wished to do at the moment was to get close to the big open grate where a cheery red and gold fire cracked. It was necessary, however, to follow the clerk. He assigned her to a small drab room, which contained a bed, a bureau, and a stationary washstand with one spigot. There was also a chair. While Carly removed her coat and hat, the clerk went downstairs for the rest of her luggage. Upon his return, Carly learned that a stage left the hotel for Oak Creek Canyon at 9 o'clock the next morning, and this cheered her so much that she faced the strange sense of loneliness and discomfort with something of fortitude. There was no heat in the room and no hot water. When Carly squeezed the spigot handle, there burst forth a torrent of water that spouted up out of the wash basin to deluge her. It was colder than any ice water she had ever felt. It was piercingly cold. Hard upon the surprise and shock, Carly suffered a flash of temper. But then the humor of it struck her, and she had to laugh. "Serves you right, you spoiled doll of luxury," she mocked. "This is out west. Shiver and wait on yourself." Never before had she undressed so swiftly, nor felt grateful for thick woolen blankets on a hard bed. Gradually she grew warm. The blackness, too, seemed rather comforting. "I'm only 20 miles from Glenn," she whispered. "How strange. I wonder, will he be glad?" She felt a sweet, glowing assurance of that. Sleep did not come readily. Excitement had laid hold of her nerves, and for a long time she lay awake. After a while, the chug of motor cars, the click of pool balls, the murmur of low voices all ceased. Then she heard a sound of wind outside, an intermittent, low moaning, new to her ears, and somehow pleasant. Another sound greeted her, the musical clanging of a clock that struck the quarters of the hour. Some time later, sleep claimed her. Upon awakening, she found she had overslept, necessitating haste upon her part. As to that, the temperature of the room did not admit of leisurely dressing. She had no adequate name for the feeling of the water, and her fingers grew so numb that she made what she considered a disgraceful matter of her attire. Downstairs in the lobby, another cheerful red fire burned in the grate. How perfectly satisfying was an open fireplace! She thrust her numb hands almost into the blaze and simply shook with the tingling pain that slowly warmed out of them. The lobby was deserted. A sign directed her to a dining room in the basement, where of the ham and eggs and strong coffee she managed to partake a little. Then she went upstairs into the lobby and out into the street. A cold, piercing air seemed to blow right through her. Walking to the near corner, she paused to look around. Down the main street flowed a leisurely stream of pedestrians, horses, cars, extending between two blocks of low buildings. Across from where she stood lay a vacant lot, beyond which began a line of neat, oddly constructed houses, evidently residences of the town. And then, lifting her gaze, instinctively drawn by something obstructing the skyline, she was suddenly struck with surprise and delight. "Oh, how perfectly splendid!" she burst out. Two magnificent mountains loomed right over her, sloping up with majestic sweep of green and black timber to a ragged, tree-fringed snow area that swept up cleaner and whiter, at last to lift pure, glistening peaks, noble and sharp, and sunrise flushed against the blue. Carly had climbed Mont Blanc, and she had seen the Matterhorn, but they had never struck such amazement and admiration from her as these twin peaks of her native land. "What mountains are those?" she asked a passerby. "San Francisco Peaks, ma'am," replied the man. "Why, they can't be over a mile away," she said. 18 miles, ma'am," he returned with a grin. "Sure this Arizona air is deceivin'." "How strange," murmured Carly. "It's not that way in the Adirondacks." She was still gazing upward when a man approached her and said the stage for Oak Creek Canyon would soon be ready to start, and he wanted to know if her baggage was ready. Carly hurried back to her room to pack. She had expected the stage would be a motor bus, or at least a large touring car, but it turned out to be a two-seated vehicle drawn by a team of ragged horses. The driver was a little wizen-faced man of doubtful years, and he did not appear obviously susceptible to the importance of his passenger. There was considerable freight to be hauled, besides Carly's luggage, but evidently she was the only passenger.
"Reckon it's going to be a bad day," said the driver. "These April days high up on the desert are windy and cold. Maybe it'll snow, too. Them clouds hanging around the peaks ain't very promising. Now, miss, haven't you a heavier coat or something?"
"No, I have not," replied Carly. "I'll have to stand it. Did you say this was desert?"
"I sure did. Well, there's a hoss blanket under the seat, and you can have that," he replied.
And, climbing to the seat in front of Carly, he took up the reins and started the horses off at a trot. At the first turning, Carly became specifically acquainted with the driver's meaning of a bad day. A gust of wind, raw and penetrating, laden with dust and stinging sand, swept full in her face. It came so suddenly that she was scarcely quick enough to close her eyes. It took considerable clumsy effort on her part with a handkerchief, aided by relieving tears, to clear her sight again. Thus, uncomfortably, Carly found herself launched on the last lap of her journey. All before her and alongside lay the squalid environs of the town. Looked back at, with the peaks rising behind, it was not unpicturesque. But the hard road with its sheets of flying dust, the bleak railroad yards, the round pens she took for cattle corrals, and the sordid debris littering the approach to a huge sawmill, these were offensive in Carly's sight. From a tall dome-like stack rose a yellowish smoke that spread overhead, adding to the lowering aspect of the sky. Beyond the sawmill extended the open country, sloping somewhat roughly, and evidently once a forest, but now a hideous bare slash, with ghastly burned stems of trees still standing, and myriads of stumps attesting to denudation. The bleak road wound away to the southwest, and from this direction came the gusty wind. It did not blow regularly so that Carly could be on her guard. It lulled now and then, permitting her to look about. And then suddenly again dust would whip into her face. The smell of the dust was as unpleasant as the sting. It made her nostrils smart. It was penetrating, and a little more of it would have been suffocating. And as a leaden gray bank of broken clouds rolled up, the wind grew stronger and the air colder. Chilled before, Carly now became thoroughly cold. There appeared to be no end to the devastated forest land, and the farther she rode, the more barren and sordid grew the landscape. Carly forgot about the impressive mountains behind her. And as the ride wore into hours, such was her discomfort and disillusion that she forgot about Glenn Kilbourn. She did not reach the point of regretting her adventure, but she grew mightily unhappy. Now and then she espied dilapidated log cabins and surroundings even more squalid than the ruined forest. What wretched abodes! Could it be possible that people lived there? She imagined men had, but hardly women and children. Somehow she had forgotten an idea that women and children were extremely scarce in the West. Straggling bits of forest, yellow pines, the driver called the trees, began to encroach upon the burned over and arid barren land. To Carly, these groves, by reason of contrast and proof of what once was, only rendered the landscape more forlorn and dreary. Why had these miles and miles of forest been cut? By money grubbers, she supposed, the same as were devastating the Adirondacks. Presently, when the driver had to halt to repair or adjust something wrong with the harness, Carly was grateful for a respite from the cold inaction. She got out and walked. Sleet began to fall, and when she returned to the seat in her vehicle, she asked the driver for the blanket to cover her. The smell of this horse blanket was less endurable than the cold. Carly huddled down into a state of apathetic misery. Already, she'd had enough of the West. But the sleet storm passed, the clouds broke, the sun shone through, greatly mitigating her discomfort. By and by, the road led into a section of real forest, unspoiled in any degree. Carly saw large gray squirrels with tufted ears and white bushy tails. Presently, the driver pointed out a flock of huge birds, which Carly, on second glance, recognized as turkeys. Only these were sleek and glossy, with flecks of bronze and black and white, quite different from turkeys back east. "There must be a farm near," said Carly, gazing about. "No, ma'am, them's wild turkeys," replied the driver, "and sure the best eatin' you ever had in your life." A little while afterwards, as they were emerging from the woodland into more denuded country,
He pointed out to Carly a herd of gray, white-rumped animals that she took to be sheep. "And them's antelope," he said. "Once this desert was overrun by antelope, then they nearly disappeared. And now they're increasing again. More barren country, more bad weather, and especially an exceedingly rough road, reduced Carly to her former state of dejection. The jolting over roots and rocks and ruts was worse than uncomfortable. She had to hold on to the seat to keep from being thrown out. The horses did not appreciably change their gait for rough sections of the road. Then a more severe jolt brought Carly's knee in violent contact with an iron bolt on the forward seat, and it hurt her so acutely that she had to bite her lips to keep from screaming. A smoother stretch of road did not come any too soon for her. It led into forest again, and Carly soon became aware that they had at last left the cut and burned over district of timberland behind. A cold wind moaned through the treetops and set the drops of water pattering down upon her. It lashed her wet face. Carly closed her eyes and sagged in her seat, mostly oblivious to the passing scenery. "The girls will never believe this of me," she soliloquized. And indeed, she was amazed at herself. The thought of Glenn strengthened her. It did not really matter what she suffered on the way to him. Only she was disgusted at her lack of stamina and her appalling sensitiveness to discomfort. "Well, yar's Oak Creek Canyon," called the driver. Carly, rousing out of her weary preoccupation, opened her eyes to see that the driver had halted at a turn in the road, where apparently it descended a fearful declivity. The very forest-fringed earth seemed to have opened into a deep abyss, ribbed by red rock walls and choked by steep mats of green timber. The chasm was a V-shaped slit, and so deep that looking downward sent at once a chill and a shudder over Carly. At that point it appeared narrow and ended in a box. In the other direction it widened and deepened, and stretched farther on between tremendous walls of red, and split its winding floor of green with glimpses of a gleaming creek, boulder-strewn and ridged by white rapids. A low, mellow roar of rushing waters floated up to Carly's ears. What a wild, lonely, terrible place! Could Glenn possibly live down there in that ragged rent in the earth? It frightened her, the sheer sudden plunge of it from the heights. Far down the gorge, a purple light shone on the forested floor. And at that moment the sun burst through the clouds and sent a golden blaze down into the depths, transforming them incalculably. The great cliffs turned gold. The creek changed to glancing silver. The green of trees vividly freshened, and in the clefts rays of sunlight burned into the blue shadows. Carly had never gazed upon a scene like this. Hostile and prejudiced, she yet felt wrung from her an acknowledgement of beauty and grandeur, but wild, violent, and savage, not livable. This insulated rift in the crust of the earth was a gigantic burrow for beasts, perhaps for outlawed men, not for a civilized person. Certainly not for Glenn Kilbourn.
"Don't be scared, ma'am," spoke up the driver. "It's safe if you're careful. And I've drove this many's the time."
Carly's heartbeat thumped at her side, rather denying her taunted assurance of fearlessness. Then the rickety vehicle started down at an angle that forced her to cling to her seat. Carly, clutching for support, with a bated breath and prickling skin, gazed in fascinated suspense over the rim of the gorge. Sometimes the wheels on that side of the vehicle passed within a few inches of the edge. The brakes squeaked, the wheels slid, and she could hear the scrape of the iron-shod hoofs of the horses as they held back stiff-legged, obedient to the wary call of the driver. The first 100 yards of that steep road cut out of the cliff appeared to be the worst. It began to widen, with descents less precipitous. Tips of trees rose level with her gaze,
obstructing sight of the blue depths. Then brush appeared on each side of the road. Gradually, Carly's strain relaxed, and also the muscular contractions by which she had braced herself in the seat. The horses began to trot again. The wheels rattled. The road wound around abrupt corners, and soon the green and red wall of the opposite side of the canyon loomed close. Low roar of running water rose to Carly's ears. When at length she looked out instead of down, she could see nothing but a mass of green foliage crossed by tree trunks and branches of brown and gray. Then the vehicle bowled under dark cool shade into a tunnel with mossy wet cliff on one side and close-standing trees on the other.
"Reckon we're all right now, unless we meet somebody coming up," declared the driver.
Carly relaxed. She drew a deep breath of relief. She had her first faint intimation that perhaps her extensive experience of motor cars, express trains, transatlantic liners, and even a little of airplanes did not range over the whole of adventurous life. She was likely to meet something entirely new and striking out here in the West. The murmur of falling water sounded closer. Presently, Carly saw that the road turned at the notch in the canyon and crossed a clear, swift stream. Here were huge mossy boulders and red walls covered by lichens, and the air appeared dim and moist and full of mellow, hollow roar. Beyond this crossing, the road descended the west side of the canyon, drawing away and higher from the creek. Huge trees, the likes of which Carly had never seen, began to stand majestically up out of the gorge, dwarfing the maples and white-spotted sycamores. The driver called these great trees yellow pines. At last the road led down from the steep slope to the floor of the canyon. What from far above had appeared only a green timber-choked cleft proved from close inspection to be a wide winding valley, up and down, densely forested for the most part, yet having open glades and bisected from wall to wall by the creek. Every quarter of a mile or so the road crossed the stream, and at these fords Carly again held on desperately and gazed out dubiously, for the creek was deep, swift, and full of boulders. Neither driver nor horses appeared to mind obstacles. Carly was splashed and jolted not inconsiderably. They passed through groves of oak trees, from which the creek manifestly derived its name, and under gleaming walls, cold, wet, gloomy, and silent, and between lines of solemn, wide-spreading pines. Carly saw deep, still green pools eddying under huge, massed jumble of cliffs and stretches of white water, and then, high above the treetops, a wild line of canyon rim cold against the sky. She felt shut in from the world, lost in an unscalable rut of the earth. Again the sunlight had failed, and the gray gloom of the canyon oppressed her. It struck Carly as singular that she could not help being affected by mere weather, mere heights and depths, mere rock walls and pine trees and rushing water. For really, what had these to do with her? These were only physical things that she was passing. Nevertheless, although she resisted sensation, she was more and more shot through and through with the wildness and savageness of this canyon. A sharp turn of the road to the right disclosed a slope down the creek, across which showed orchards and fields, and a cottage nestling at the base of the wall. The ford at this crossing gave Carly more concern than any that had passed, for there was greater volume and depth of water. One of the horses slipped on the rocks, plunged up and on with great splash. They crossed, however, without more mishap to Carly than further acquaintance with this iciest of waters. From this point, the driver turned back along the creek, passed between orchards and fields, and drove along the base of the red wall to come suddenly upon a large rustic house that had been hidden from Carly's sight. It sat almost against the stone cliff, from which poured a white foamy sheet of water. The house was built of slabs with the bark on, and it had a lower and upper porch running all around, at least as far as the cliff. Green growths from the rock wall overhung the upper porch. A column of blue smoke curled lazily upward from a stone chimney. On one of the porch posts hung a sign with rude lettering, Lolomi Lodge.
"Hey, Josh, did you fetch the flour?"
called a woman's voice from inside.
"Hello, I reckon I didn't forget nothing," replied the man as he got down. "And say, Mrs. Hunter, yar's a young lady from New York."
That latter speech of the driver's brought Mrs. Hunter out on the porch.
"Flo, come here," she called to someone evidently at hand,
and then she smilingly greeted Carly.
"Get down and come in, miss," she said. "I'm sure glad to see you."
Carly, being stiff and cold, did not very gracefully disengage from the high, muddy wheel and step. When she mounted to the porch, she saw that Mrs. Hutter was a woman of middle age, rather stout, with strong face full of fine, wavy lines, and kind, dark eyes.
"I'm Miss Birch," said Carly. "You're the girl whose picture Glenn Kilbourne has over his fireplace," declared the woman heartily. "I'm sure glad to meet you, and my daughter Flo will be, too."
That about her picture pleased and warmed Carly.
"Yes, I'm Glenn Kilbourne's fiancée. I've come west to surprise him. Is he here? Is he well?"
"Fine. I saw him yesterday. He's changed a great deal from what he was at first, most all the last few months. I reckon you won't know him. But you're wet and cold and look fagged. Come right into the fire."
"Thank you, I'm all right," returned Carly.
At the door they encountered a girl of lithe and robust figure, quick in her movements. Carly was swift to see the youth and grace of her, and then a face that struck Carly as neither pretty nor beautiful, but still wonderfully attractive.
"Flo, here's Miss Birch," burst out Mrs. Hutter, with cheerful importance. "Glenn Kilbourne's girl come all the way from New York to surprise him."
"Oh, Carly, I'm sure happy to meet you," said the girl, in a voice of slow, drawling richness.
"I know you. Glenn has told me all about you."
If this greeting, sweet and warm as it seemed, was a shock to Carly, she gave no sign. But as she murmured something in reply, she looked with all a woman's keenness into the face before her. Flo Hutter had a fair skin, generously freckled, a mouth and chin too firmly cut to suggest a softer feminine beauty, and eyes of clear light hazel, penetrating, frank, and fearless. Her hair was very abundant, almost silver gold in color, and it was either rebellious or showed lack of care. Carly liked the girl's looks, liked the sincerity of her greeting, but instinctively she reacted antagonistically because of the frank suggestion of intimacy with Glenn. But for that, she would have been spontaneous and friendly rather than restrained. They ushered Carly into a big living room and up to a fire of blazing logs, where they helped divest her of the wet wraps. And all the time they talked in the solicitous way natural to women who were kind and unused to many visitors. Then Mrs. Hutter bustled off to make a cup of hot coffee while Flo talked.
"We'll sure give you the nicest room, with a sleeping porch right under the cliff where the water falls. It'll sing you to sleep. Of course, you needn't use the bed outdoors until it's warmer. Spring is late here, you know, and we'll have nasty weather yet. You really happened on Oak Creek at its least attractive season, but then it's always, well, just Oak Creek, you'll come to know."
"I dare say I'll remember my first sight of it in the ride down the cliff road," said Carly, with a wan smile.
"Oh, that's nothing to what you'll see and do," returned Flo knowingly. "We've had Eastern tenderfeet here before, and never was there a one of them who didn't come to love Arizona."
"Tenderfoot? It hadn't occurred to me. But of course," murmured Carly.
Then Mrs. Hutter returned, carrying a tray, which she set upon a chair, and drew to Carly's side.
"Eat and drink, she said, as if these actions were the cardinally important ones of life. Flo, you carry her bags up to that west room we always give to some particular person we want to love, Lolomi. Next she threw sticks of wood upon the fire, making it crackle and blaze, then seated herself next to Carly and beamed upon her. You'll not mind if we call you Carly? She asked eagerly. Oh, indeed, no. I'd like it, returned Carly, made to feel friendly and at home, in spite of herself. You see, it's not as if you were just a stranger, went on Mrs. Hutter. Tom, that's Flo's father, took a liking to Glenn Kilbourne when he first came to Oak Creek over a year ago. I wonder if you all know how sick that soldier boy was. Well, he lay on his back for 2 solid weeks in the room we're giving you, and I, for one, didn't think he'd ever get up. But he did, and he got better, and after a while he went to work for Tom. Then 6 months and more ago he invested in the sheep business with Tom. He lived with us until he built his cabin up West Fork. He and Flo have run together a good deal, and naturally he told her about you. So you see, you're not a stranger, and we want you to feel you're with friends. I thank you, Mrs. Hutter, replied Carly, feelingly. I never could thank you enough for being so good to Glenn. I didn't know he was so sick. At first he wrote, but seldom. Reckon he never wrote you or told you what he did in the war, declared Mrs. Hutter. Indeed, he never did. Well, I'll tell you someday, for Tom found out all about him. Got some of it from a soldier who come to Flagstaff for lung trouble. He'd been in the same company with Glenn. We didn't know this boy's name while he was in Flagstaff, but later Tom found out. John Henderson. He was only 22, a fine lad, and he died in Phoenix. We tried to get him out here, but the boy wouldn't live on charity. He was always expecting money, a war bonus, whatever that was. It didn't come. He was a clerk at the El Tovar for a while. Then he came to Flagstaff, but it was too cold and he stayed there too long. Too bad, rejoined Carly, thoughtfully. This information as to the suffering of American soldiers had augmented during the last few months and seemed to possess strange, poignant power to depress Carly. Always she had turned away from the unpleasant, and the misery of unfortunates was as disturbing almost as direct contact with disease and squalor. But it began to dawn upon Carly that there might occur circumstances of life, in every way affronting her comfort and happiness, which it would be impossible to turn away from. At this juncture, Flo returned to the room, and again Carly was struck with the girl's singular freedom of movement and the sense of sure poise and joy that seemed to emanate from her presence. I've made a fire in your little stove, she said. There's water heating. Now won't you come up and change those traveling clothes? You'll want to fix up for Glenn, won't you? Carly had to smile at that. This girl indeed was frank and unsophisticated, and somehow refreshing. Carly rose. You are both very good to receive me as a friend, she said. I hope I shall not disappoint you. Yes, I do want to improve my appearance before Glenn sees me. Is there any way I can send word to him by someone who has not seen me? There sure is. I'll send Charlie, one of our hired boys. Thank you. Then tell him to say there's a lady here from New York to see him, and it's very important. Flo Hutter clapped her hands and laughed with glee. Her gladness gave Carly a little twinge of conscience. Jealousy was an unjust and stifling thing. Carly was conducted up a broad stairway and along a boarded hallway to a room that opened out on the porch. A steady low murmur of falling water assailed her ears. Through the open door, she saw across the porch to a white, tumbling, lacy veil of water falling, leaping, changing, so close that it seemed to touch the heavy pole railing of the porch. This room resembled a tent. The sides were of canvas. It had no ceiling.
but the rough-hewn shingles of the roof of the house sloped down closely. The furniture was homemade. An Indian rug covered the floor. The bed, with its woolly, clean blankets and white pillows, looked inviting. "Is this where Glenn lay when he was sick?" queried Carly. "Yes," replied Flo bravely, and a shadow darkened her eyes. "I ought to tell you about it. I will some day. But you must not be made unhappy now. Glenn nearly died here. Mother or I never left his side for a while there when life was so bad." She showed Carly how to open the little stove and put the short billets of wood inside and work the damper, and cautioning her to keep an eye on it so that it would not get too hot, she left Carly to herself. Carly found herself in an unfamiliar mood. There came a leap of her heart every time she thought of the meeting with Glenn, so soon now to be. But it was not that which was unfamiliar. She seemed to be harboring undefined and unusual thoughts. All this was so different from her regular life. Besides, she was tired. But these explanations did not suffice. There was a pang in her breast, which must owe its origin to the fact that Glenn Kilbourn had been ill in this little room, and some other girl than Carly Birch had nursed him. "Am I jealous?" she whispered. "No!" But she knew in her heart that she lied. A woman could no more help being jealous under such circumstances than she could help the beat and throb of her blood. Nevertheless, Carly was glad Flo Hutter had been there, and always would she be grateful to her for that kindness. Carly disrobed, and, donning her dressing gown, she unpacked her bags and hung her things upon pegs under the curtained shelves. Then she lay down to rest, with no intention of slumber. But there was a strange magic in the fragrance of the room, like the piney tang outdoors, and in the feel of the bed, and especially in the low, dreamy hum and murmur of the waterfall. She fell asleep. When she awakened, it was 5 o'clock. The fire in the stove was out, but the water was still warm. She bathed and dressed, not without care, yet as swiftly as was her habit at home. And she wore white because Glenn had always liked her best in white. But it was assuredly not a gown to wear in a country house where drafts of cold air filled the unheated rooms and halls. So she threw round her a warm sweater shawl with colorful bars becoming to her dark eyes and hair. All the time that she dressed and thought, her very being seemed to be permeated by that soft murmuring sound of falling water. No moment of waking life there at the Lomi Lodge, or perhaps of slumber hours, could be wholly free of that sound. It vaguely tormented Carly, yet was not uncomfortable. She went out upon the porch. The small alcove space held a bed and a rustic chair. Above her, the peeled poles of the roof descended to within a few feet of her head. She had to lean over the rail of the porch to look up. The green and red rock wall sheered ponderously near. The waterfall showed first at the notch of a fissure where the cliff split, and down over smooth places the water gleamed, to narrow in a crack with little drops and suddenly to leap into thin white sheet. Out from the porch, the view was restricted to glimpses between the pines and beyond at the opposite wall of the canyon. How shut in, how walled in this home! "In summer, it might be good to spend a couple of weeks here," soliloquized Carly. "But to live here? Heaven, a person might as well be buried." Heavy steps upon the porch below, accompanied by a man's voice, quickened Carly's pulse. Did they belong to Glenn? After a strained second, she decided not. Nevertheless, the acceleration of her blood and an unwonted glow of excitement, long a stranger to her, persisted as she left the porch and entered the boarded hall. How gray and barn-like this upper part of the house! From the head of the stairway, however, the big living room presented a cheerful contrast. There were warm colors, some comfortable rockers, a lamp that shed a bright light, and an open fire which alone would have dispelled the raw gloom of the day. A large man in corduroys and top boots advanced to meet Carly. He had a clean-shaven face that might have been hard and stern but for his smile, and one look into his eyes revealed their resemblance to Flo's. "I'm Tom Hunter, and I'm sure glad to welcome you to La Loma, Miss Carly," he said. His voice was deep and slow. There was ease and force in his presence, and the grip he gave Carly's hand was that of a man who made no distinction in handshaking. Carly, quick in her perceptions, instantly liked him and sensed in him a strong personality. She greeted him in turn and expressed her thanks for his goodness to Glenn. Naturally, Carly expected him to say something about her fiancé, but he did not. "Well, Miss Carly, if you don't mind, I'll say you're prettier than your picture," said Hutter, "and that is sure saying a lot. All the sheepherders in the country have taken a peep at your picture, without permission, you understand." "I'm greatly flattered," laughed Carly. "We're glad you come," replied Hutter simply. "I just got back from the East myself, Chicago and Kansas City. I came to Arizona from Illinois over 30 years ago, and this was my first trip since. Reckon I've not got back my breath yet. Times have changed, Miss Carly, times and people." Mrs. Hutter bustled in from the kitchen, where manifestly she had been importantly engaged. "For the land's sake," she explained fervently, as she threw up her hands at the sight of Carly. Her expression was indeed a compliment, but there was a suggestion of shock in it. Then Flo came in. She wore a simple gray gown that reached the top of her high shoes. "Carly, don't mind Mother," said Flo. "She means your dress is lovely, which is my say, too. But listen, I just saw Glenn coming up the road." Carly ran to the open door with more haste than dignity. She saw a tall man striding along. Something about him appeared familiar. It was his walk, an erect, swift carriage, with a swing of the march still visible. She recognized Glenn, and all within her seemed to become unstable. She watched him cross the road, face the house. How changed! No, this was not Glenn Kilbourn. This was a bronzed man, wide of shoulder, roughly garbed, heavy-limbed. Quite different from the Glenn she remembered. He mounted the porch steps, and Carly, still unseen herself, saw his face. Yes, Glenn! Hot blood seemed to be tingling, liberated in her veins. Wheeling away, she backed against the wall behind the door and held up a warning finger to Flo, who stood nearest. Strange and disturbing, then, to see something in Flo Hutter's eyes that could be read by a woman in only one way. A tall form darkened the doorway. It strode in and halted. "Flo! Who? Where?" he began, breathlessly. His frame had so filled out that she did not recognize it. His face, too, had unbelievably changed, not in the regularity of feature that had been its chief charm, but in contour of cheek and vanishing of pallid hue and tragic line. Carly's heart swelled with joy. Beyond all else, she had hoped to see the sad, fixed hopelessness, the havoc, gone from his face. Therefore, the restraint and nonchalance upon which Carly prided herself sustained eclipse. "Glenn, look who's here," she called in a voice that she could have not steadied to save her life. This meeting was more than she had anticipated. Glenn whirled with an inarticulate cry. He saw Carly. Then, no matter how unreasonable or exacting had been Carly's longings, they were satisfied. "You!" he cried, and leaped at her with radiant face. Carly not only did not care about the spectators of this meeting, but forgot them utterly. More than the joy of seeing Glenn, more than the all-satisfying assurance to her woman's heart that she was still beloved, welled up a deep, strange, profound something that shook her to her depths. It was beyond selfishness. It was gratitude to God and to the West that had restored him. "Carly, I couldn't believe it was you," he declared, releasing her from his close embrace, yet still holding her. "Yes, Glenn, it's I. All you've left of me," she replied tremulously, and she sought with unsteady hands to put up her disheveled hair. You big sheepherd, you Goliath? I was never so knocked off my pins," he said. "A lady to see me, from New York. Of course it had to be you, but I couldn't believe. Carly, you were good to come." Somehow the soft, warm look of the dark eyes hurt her. New and strange indeed it was to her, as were other things about him. Why had she not come west sooner? She disengaged herself from his hold and moved away, striving for the composure habitual with her. Flo Hutter was standing before the fire, looking down. Mrs. Hutter beamed upon Carly. "Now, let's have supper." And that concludes our segment of Zane Grey's Call of the Canyon. As I said before, one of my favorite Zane Grey novels. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope it piques your interest in listening to more Zane Grey in the future. Thank you for joining us today for Western Short Stories. And this has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cowboys saw a plowing through the ragged sky and up the cloudy draw.
Hello, this is Michael with a programming reminder. The coronavirus update will now air this afternoon following the local newspapers at 4:30 p.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
Sherwood Church of Christ, 4900 North Dixie Boulevard, offers free clothing on the first Saturday of every month. With so many families in the community are losing their jobs due to COVID and the downturn in oil, the Sherwood Clothes Closet is an opportunity for people to find needed clothing items for the entire family. Hours are 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't let physical challenges limit your imagination. Each week, the guys on The Blind Handyman answer questions and offer tips on home maintenance and upgrades. The Blind Handyman, direct from Lufkin, Texas. Monday nights at 7, Saturdays at noon, and Sunday nights at 11 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble to the sea.